You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Well, I'm Brian Wilson, joined today by our good friend Tony Schaefer.
Good morning.
Who was out there doing some work right now and advising the incoming Trump administration on intelligence matters. So good to have you here with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Very helpful to have your expertise available to us. Joining us on the line right now is Brett Baer from the Fox News Channel. And Brett's got a new book. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. But Brett, I guess I have to talk about the other things that are going on there at Fox News. There are some major changes that have taken place since we last spoke.
Good morning, guys. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shakeup. And we're excited. You know, I'm very happy for Megan. She's a real pro, and I know she's going to do great. And we've had some great times on the anchor desk together. So tonight is her last night, and I'll be saying something on my show about that. But Martha McCallum goes to 7 p.m., and she'll be anchoring the inauguration coverage with me and the big political events. And Tucker Carlson moves to 9 p.m., so he is moving up the evening schedule as far as getting to sleep in a little bit later.
I have two more questions. One is, first of all, you know, Megyn Kelly, you and I were both there together in the Fox News when she walked into the newsroom, and she has really proven herself to be an amazing talent who grasped, you know, the basics of television in a fashion so breathtakingly fast, I can hardly believe it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's shot up, and obviously this year's events and our first debate in Cleveland in August of 2015, she's definitely been skyrocketing. So yeah. I wish her the best. The thing that she made her decision, she told friends, and I texted with her, was that it was about her kids.
Yeah,
you got to really respect that.
Yeah, and on just one other thing, I understand you just celebrated an anniversary doing Special Report.
I did, 8 years.
Eight?
Hard to believe.
Wow. Hardly believe it's been 8 years.
Eight years yesterday, taking over the chair from our friend, Britt Hume. And it's been a great ride. I mean, Special Report is, is a lot because of the staff and the correspondents who make the show and really drive the news in the show.
Yeah.
Hey, right. Brett, you got a new book coming out, 3 days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's Final Mission. And on retrospect, I think a lot of folks, to include me as a political scientist, have come to respect President Eisenhower's time in office. So a couple things. First, what were you thinking? How did you come to this as a subject for a book, which I think is a great topic? And secondly, are you prepared for the promotion tour, which is often more difficult than actually writing the book?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it starts next week, and I'm excited. Tony, thanks. I started thinking, the last book I wrote was A Special Heart about my son, and it was emotional and cathartic, and it helped a lot of people, I think, including me. But I wanted to write something more along my line and political thinking and history. And oftentimes when we think about politics, it's 30-second sound bites now, and now we're covering tweets. This enabled me to really get into something. And long story short, I was invited to the Holy Grail of golf invitations at Augusta National, first time ever, and they put me up in the Eisenhower cabin. And I went in there, and I couldn't sleep. I was jacked up, and I poured myself a glass of wine, and I walked around. And I suddenly realized that, you know, for our generation and younger, it seems like history started with Kennedy, you know, in talking about things. Mm-hmm. And as I was looking at all of the memorabilia and the writings, I thought, there's got to be a way. I know there have been a lot of books about Eisenhower, but there's got to be a way to introduce him and his presidency in a different way. So then I left Augusta soon thereafter, and I went to Abilene, Kansas, and spent some time with the people out there. If you have not been to the Presidential Library, Eisenhower Presidential Library, it's a fantastic place to be. I talked to them, and I said, what element of Eisenhower has not really been mined? Mm-hmm. And it was this transition and the farewell speech, the military-industrial complex.
Great speech.
And using that as a soda straw, those 3 days, to then jump back and look at all of the things Eisenhower did with his leadership and his presidency.
And what was the major revelation that you came up with as a result of your research?
Yeah, the major revelation is that everybody always thinks about D-Day and General Eisenhower and all the things he did in the war. But it is often overlooked all the substantial things he did as president And in part because it was this, and political scientists have written about this, the hidden hand of leadership. He let other people kind of drive things.
He delegated.
He didn't take credit all the time.
Yeah.
He let his cabinet debate things. But under Eisenhower, we had peace for 8 years. He got us out of the Korean War. The National Highway System was formed.
Yeah, which is an amazing thing when you think about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
The first piece of civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. We had a booming economy, and this is in the middle of a dangerous time of the Cold War.
Right.
So we found some really interesting anecdotes and nuggets in the stuff at the library.
Well, about his speech real quick. I mean, one of the notable things he said in his speech is being aware of the military-industrial complex. And I would argue since him as a president, there's been very few presidents being willing to take on it until, dare I say, Mr. Trump, who's been poking the heck out of the military-industrial complex. So, do you think that's significant, that he recognized that as a threat and we've not addressed that properly regarding the overwhelming nature of sometimes the military industry kind of running the road rather than presidents?
Yes. In fact, you know, it directly applies to today, Tony. I mean, Eisenhower originally wanted to call it the military-industrial congressional complex.
Right.
Because it was the lobbyists and the influence in lawmakers and then shaping policy to change things. He left out congressional because he thought it would be too pointed towards lawmakers, but the message was the same. And also in that speech was concern about bipartisanship, about the deficit, about spending, about long-term planning. The speech is, if you dig into it, is really quite something, but I think that the heart of it is that concern that that the companies would have so much influence.
Which they have.
In politicians. And look what's happened today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and now it seems that we have a president who in 140 characters can bring major, major defense contractors to their knees.
My airplane's too expensive.
So it's a different, definitely a different communication style.
It certainly is.
You know, Eisenhower was all about, he was the first, by the way, TV president. He had the first press conference on the record, and he also had the first broadcast press conference. So a lot of people didn't know that. Before Eisenhower, every president could meet with reporters, but reporters could never quote them directly.
Yeah.
Eisenhower was the first president that was quoted directly.
Wow. All right. Well, listen, I am actually looking forward to reading your book, Brett. It sounds like a very interesting bit of research that you've done there.
Yeah, it's been fun. It's been a lot of fun.
Well,
and it translates to today, obviously, with there's a lot of things to learn that basically, we can see today, especially with Russia, with the threat from North Korea, I mean, that leadership style,
Deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
All right, Brett Baer, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brett.
Always a pleasure.
See ya.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
Cully Stimson is on the line right now to talk about what's going on with Guantanamo Bay. They're releasing more Gitmo detainees, and he has the very latest on that. Good morning to you, Cully.
Good morning, Jesse, or I should say Gunny, and Brian, thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. He serves as a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation, but also was at the Pentagon, an assistant secretary for defense for detainee affairs, so he knows a lot about this topic. All right, I'm reading that to four detainees are about to be released from Guantanamo Bay and sent to Saudi Arabia. This is either happening now or is going to happen in the next few hours. But that's not the worst of it. The worst of it is that the Obama tends to transfer and get rid of some 22 people that are currently in Guantanamo before he leaves office. What's going on?
Yeah, so these four have been approved for transfer to Saudi Arabia, and there are 23 total down there of the 59 that are there that have already been approved for transfer. So you should expect to see in the coming days before January 20th, most, if not all, of those 23 leave the island and be transferred to some other country. And, of course, President-elect Trump said, stop it, done, no more. And the White House is legally within their rights to say, sorry, we want to do this.
Well, there have been so many transfers already, and you're going to get rid of 23 more, which will leave only 36 people, I think, at Guantanamo Bay. Well, it would seem when you get down to around, you know, 50 or so, you're talking about the bad guys, the really bad guys.
Let's not be cute about it. Most of the last few hundred are bad guys. I mean, these are
the worst.
Law of war detainees. And it's a weird war, and I'm sure the gunny would wave in here completely and agree with me, that, you know, it's a weird war where you're releasing the enemy while you're still at war with the enemy. I mean, I can't think of another war where we've done that. There were 790 guys down at Gitmo. We're down to 59 now. We'll probably be down to, you know, 29 or so. Almost a dozen of them are facing military commissions trials, including the 9/11 co-conspirators. But I think if you're there on that island on January 20th, when President Trump is sworn in, you're there for a while.
You know, one of the things that really disturbs me is that Saudi Arabia is also a known sponsor of terrorism, that they have actually been associated and ties and links to ISIS, funding with them, and Muslim Brotherhood and radicals. So it's just, to me, seems like a wink and a nod going on here, because like you just said, we're still at war with the enemy. We're sending them over to someone who helps sponsor our enemy. What is your take on that?
Well, the big three populations at Gitmo were the Saudis, the Yemenis, and the Afghans. And we've sent a lot of people back to Saudi Arabia, some to their terrorist rehabilitation program, which has been fairly successful. But keep in mind, the Obama numbers show through the DNI that about 30 to 31% of Gitmo graduates have either gone back to confirmed or suspected have gone back to terrorism. So there's no risk-free transfer from Gitmo, and there never will be.
So is there anything that can be done? I mean, or does the president have carte blanche to continue to transfer these people out as long as he is still the president?
Yeah, and the consequences are that he will suffer the political ramifications of it. But, of course, I don't think he really cares because he's leaving office. But, yeah, he has almost unfettered discretion. As long as he gives the requisite notice under the law to the Congress has done nothing once they've gotten the notice. And so you can expect to see folks be transferred off the island between now and January 19th.
So essentially you're saying Congress, even if they – is there anything that Congress could do to intervene? I mean, we know they don't intervene, but could they? Or is there someone up at the Pentagon that could intervene?
Well, nobody at the Pentagon is going to intervene because they follow lawful orders, and these are lawful orders to transfer these folks. Congress could have last year attempted to cut off funding of transfers completely. I think that's probably a separation of powers issue, and the president probably enjoys the constitutional authority to do so because he is the commander-in-chief. So I don't think there's anything that can be done.
I noticed that we do not know the identities. I again apologize. We don't know the identities of the people who are being released out of Guantanamo right now, the four detainees. Shouldn't we be able to get that information? Isn't that something that the public has a valid reason to know? Because if we can identify who they are, then we know what they may have done, and we as a public that wants to know what's going on at Guantanamo can make an independent judgment about whether or not we agree or disagree with that policy.
The practice has always been, Brian, and this is during the Bush administration also, is to not to pre-release the names of the person we release or transfer for security reasons. And I think those reasons are still valid. And you do find out after the transfer takes place the names of the persons. And, of course, with WikiLeaks and all the other information that's out there, you can find out what the review boards and other information about Gitmo.
Well, let me ask it another way. Is there anybody left in Gitmo right now that you think is deserving to be transferred out?
No.
Well, what about the president's claim that we've had no terrorist attacks in this country in the last 8 years? I mean, we're looking at this now. He's releasing people, you know, like he's just pulled this plug on the bathtub. They're all draining out. How much longer what is your take on this? And do you think any of these terrorists are going to come back to haunt us? Because as I recall, many have.
Yeah, well, of course, this was, you know, very carefully crafted wordsmanship by the president's lawyer. And I'm a lawyer, and, you know, words matter. I mean, but he's talking about he's forgetting things like Fort Hood, San Bernardino, Orlando shooting, the Tsarnaev brothers in Boston, the Christmas Day bomber that happened, you know, the underwear bomber that happened at Christmas Day on 2009. He's saying that those were workplace violence or non Islamic-directed attacks in the United States. Well, of course, they were inspired by Islamists and ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And the Heritage Foundation, where I work, has tracked over 93 Islamist-inspired terrorist attacks or plots on U.S. soil since 9/11. And, I mean, we've had them recently. Ohio State University, back in November 2016, the car that drove into the crowd. There's tons of them. The Seaside Park bombing, St. Cloud, Minnesota, just a few weeks ago, the stabbing, the Orlando nightclub massacre in June of last year, 49 dead, 50 injured. I mean, the list goes on and on.
And Adal Hassan.
Yeah. Well, listen, here's the thing. If there are going to be 23 people released and there is a 30% recidivism rate, that means that roughly seven of these terrorists that are being released from Guantanamo will return to the battlefield.
Exactly.
Now, be careful, Brian. That's higher math.
I know, and my math is always suspect, but I actually did check that out on the computer.
Well, you're telling an English major, so I'll go with your numbers. there's been no risk-free transfer from that island, and, you know, President-elect Trump says he's going to load Gitmo up with, quote-unquote, bad dudes. We'll see whether that happens. But I think if you're there on January 20th, you're there for a while.
You're there for a while. Thank you. Cully Stimson, always a pleasure. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. The best of Mornings on the Mall.
Joining us on the line right now, Michael Durso, who is the president of the Montgomery County School Board. And we asked him to come on because we saw this story yesterday in the Washington Post. And I love this quote from Michael Durso. It has to do with what time do the high schoolers go to school? Because, you know, there was a big study and a lot of discussion about what time they should go to school. And they ultimately moved school back some 20 minutes so that the poor, precious snowflakes could get more sleep, as some have suggested they need. But there have been, according to Michael Durso, some unintended consequences from all of that. He joins us now on the line. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. Good morning. Good to be on.
All right. So what are the unintended consequences that have cropped up now that you've moved these hours around for the high school students?
Well, as you might know, or as the listeners may not know, we start with our high school students. We then have a run with our middle school students and then two groups of elementary students that are picked up by the buses.
Right.
It's that last group that we call Tier 2, which dismiss somewhere around 4 o'clock that has caused some problems. Generally, it seems that the middle school and high school parents are pleased with the later start. Many would like even a later start, but it really has created some issues for that last group that frequently are late being picked up. It's caused a drop in some after-school activities. If the buses are late, you sometimes have kids then who are walkers or walking home from their bus stop, getting dark, and that's a concern for parents. So we're going to look at it and see if there's some things that maybe we can tinker with, but it's a difficult issue. Especially since there are price tags involved.
There are price tags, but it's also this thing that if you fix it for one, you make it worse for somebody else, right? I mean, there are only so many ways you can work that equation, right?
It is an issue where it's been a challenge to keep everybody happy.
So let me ask you, you know, we know that and parents have been crying out to have their teenagers go to school later. And we know that after kids hit puberty, according to the National Sleep Foundation, that their internal clocks shift by about 2 hours. So when they used to fall asleep at 9, now they don't fall asleep until 11. So now they want to sleep 2 hours later in the morning. So I guess the question is, do you just tell them to suck it up, buttercup, like our generation was told and every generation before them, and you will get up, and this is preparing them for real life, where you have to get up and go to work? Or do you try, how do you accommodate it, even if it's a 2-hour shift? That's unrealistic.
No, it absolutely is, and I'm not sure if it's a bit of a generational issue. There are also some interesting studies in how connected to our devices
there you go.
Well, that's
the problem.
See, that's what we wonder about. I mean, how much of this is that the kids, you know, need more sleep, or how much of it is they won't turn off their cell phones and go to bed?
Well, I think that's an issue, and there's been some publicity around that in terms of how then it becomes even more difficult for our teens, especially to actually get to sleep. And so, you know, we could adjust the times just hypothetically. And I'm not sure it wouldn't mean that the kids just feel like, well, now I can just stay up later.
Right, exactly.
Well, let me ask, is it possible then that you'll go back to the old way? Because you know you're going to catch hell from some of these parents who wanted the later start times.
I think what we hope to do is maybe there's a way to make some adjustments for the elementaries that would not impact severely the middle and high school. But yeah, you're right. There's some concern that going back is not going to be helpful either. So we're in the middle of it.
Now, let me ask, is this outcry, this hue and cry from the parents, something relatively new, or has this been going on for years and years and years, and you just decided, all right, we're going to address this?
Well, I think the whole sleep issue, I've been involved in schools for a long time. I was a high school principal where the start times, when I was in D.C., we started at 9, and then when I was in Arlington, it was 7:25, as it was in Montgomery County. So it's kind of all over the landscape. I think we've become more educated over the years as to the whole issue of sleep with teenagers. But again, some other unintended consequences. It's ironic that this discussion follows weather and traffic, because those are two big issues. I can tell you this morning, first day back after the holiday with rain, there'll be a lot of buses running late, and you might think, yeah, well, what difference does 20 minutes make? But for most households who are on a tight schedule in the morning getting kids out and parents to work, you know, a few minutes shift either way can really be a big difference.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because it trickles down. But the first shift is late, then the next shift is late, and by the time you get to the last group, they're an hour late.
Yeah. Did you anticipate when you changed when they changed this policy? Were you there when they had the discussions? And did you anticipate that it was the elementary kids who were going to take the hit, not getting home, you know, in some cases until it's dark in the winter months?
I don't think that was as much of a factor. The elementary parents and the elementary folks were not as involved, at least vocally, as some of the
well, until it started to impact them, right?
Right, exactly.
Parents,
yeah,
yeah. And then, you know, we have to keep in mind, as strange as it may seem, we have some kids, we have some families where kids get up and out, you know, on their own in the morning. And another solution has been, well, why not have the elementary kids start first? And that was looked at, too. But there are a lot of families, again, that count on the middle and high school students to be there when their elementary brothers and sisters come home. So there are many different angles.
Wow.
Yeah, well.
Who knew it could be so complicated?
I don't envy you this task. I really don't. I don't know how you're going to get into it. But, I mean, this is the one thing I loved in this story about from the Washington Post is your quote, which said, I think there have been some unintended consequences. And that happens so many times where you set out to try to do something that you think is going to help people. And then you find out, uh-oh, it didn't help everyone. In fact, this other thing was the result of that, and we didn't see that coming. I don't envy you the task of trying to repair this one.
Well, sometimes, as we all know, the what may look to be a perfect solution sometimes falls a little bit short. So we'll take a look at it, and perhaps there's some adjustments that can be made. But, no, you're right. For us to think that that everybody's going to embrace what we're doing now or if there are any changes probably is a bit naive.
All right. Well, the next discussion on this is, I think, the 10th of this month. So thank you very much, Michael Durso, president of the Montgomery County Public School Board. And by the way, if you say, well, this is Montgomery County, look, no, this debate is going on everywhere.
Yeah.
In every school district, they're having this conversation.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Now, more of the best of Mornings on the Mall.
I'm Brian Wilson. We're very happy to be joined today by Colonel Tony Schaefer, a man who understands a lot about the intelligence community.
Morning, Brian.
A man who has been working with the Trump people on the transition effort, a senior fellow at the Center for Policy Research. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so joining us on the line right now is Rod Wheeler, a man who knows how police investigations go. We wanted to bring him in on this very tragic, very horrific case out of Chicago, which has now been determined to be a hate crime.
They're young adults, and they make stupid decisions. That certainly will be part of whether or not a hate crime is, if we seek a hate crime, to determine whether or not this is sincere or just stupid ranting and raving.
Well, ultimately, they did decide that it was a hate crime. Good morning to you, Rod Wheeler.
Good morning, Brian. Good to be with you.
You know, first of all, let's just get that out of the way. We had a case that had an element about race because this man, if you don't know the story, there was a mentally disabled man held against his will by four African-American individuals. He was forced to say things like F Trump and F white people. He was a white individual, and he was abused, he was tortured, he was held against his will, and eventually the four people who were arrested were charged with many things, including hate crime. But initially, Chicago police couldn't decide whether or not all that actually added up to being a hate crime.
Well, I think they had to be politically correct, and I just suspect, and I can only suspect, because I'm not actually involved in that investigation, but it seems to me that we see this trend happening where politicians have so much to say in terms of the way police officers and police investigators conduct their business, and it's really interfering with the way that we conduct investigations. And so I think that the police superintendent in Chicago really wanted to call this a hate crime initially, but was probably forbidden because of maybe the mayor, Rahm Emanuel. I don't know. But it seems to be that way to me. Look, this was clearly, Brian, a hate crime. And here's the thing about it. You don't even have to try to figure it out why, because the suspects themselves made it, said themselves on the video why they were doing this. You know, they said F white people and F Donald Trump. This is a hate crime. It has all the elements there, and it should have been considered a hate crime initially. I'm glad that it ultimately was considered that.
Hey, Rod, it's Tony Schaefer here. I just, as a layman, and I'm a former intelligence officer, so I always try to look at things factually, and especially when something is, as you point out, as blatant as the suspects admitting the motive and what's behind it. Why is it we cannot have police leadership, such as in Chicago, just be honest? Why can't we do that?
You know, Tony, that's an excellent question, but I'll tell you, it's not the police leadership. And I've said this, and Brian and I have talked about this before. It's the elected officials that have to be, or feel like they have to be, politically correct.
Yeah.
They're trying to appease to their base. Look, I'll tell you, we can go case after case, crime after crime that has occurred, including, Tony, the terrorism-related crimes.
Look, oh, yeah.
San Bernardino, how long it took for the government to call that terrorism. I mean, if that's not terrorism, what is? Look at what happened down in Dallas, Texas. That's not terrorism and racism. What is with the police officers down there in Houston, Texas?
Right.
So, you know, we see this over and over and over again, and it's really not the police department's fault, if you want my opinion. I think it's the elected officials.
Well, when the president of the United States calls it a hate crime, you have little you can do but jump on board. But one imagine, I mean, I'll just make this an observation, we'll move on. One imagines that if this had been a black individual tied up and held against his or her will by three or four white people, right, that the jets from the Justice Department would be fueled in about 10 minutes and they'd be headed that way.
Oh, we'd be marching and protesting, and Al Sharpton and everybody else would be here. But, you know, let me just mention this real quickly, Brian. I think what we see here, what happened in Chicago with that young individual being tortured, inhumanely tortured by four other individuals, I think this is a greater problem. I don't think it's just that. I think we have an underlying issue going on in this country, and what frightens me more, and I'd like to hear Tony's opinion about this as an intelligence officer, what frightens me more is that we're going to start seeing more and more of this race-baited, race-related crime and activity and torture and things like that going forward. It just seems to me that this is representative of what's to come.
Well, I think, Rod, your point's well taken. Look, I mean, think about this. These guys were basically doing Facebook Live in real-time torture. So somehow in their mind, the perpetrator's mind, this was okay. This is something that is permitted. So
yeah.
I think we have to take a step back and think about that very thing. It's like, how now can we think about something like that being permissible? And it goes to your point. It's like everything it seems to be, if you allow something to happen, it continues to expand on its own until someone does something to stop it. And nobody seems willing to actually say,
well, these guys were not the brightest individuals. I mean, they did actually broadcast torture on Facebook Live where it was seen by. And then by the way, now that's pretty key evidence in this particular case. There have been another case in Maryland, actually, where Facebook was used to lure a person down to Montgomery County, and then they actually lured this guy out into the woods and killed him, and apparently it's gang activity. There is this element now, it seems to me, of criminals using social media.
You're exactly right, Brian, and I'll just add a little bit more to that. When you speak with the police chief from Prince George's County, which is the county that I live in, and at the 8 o'clock hour, ask him about some of these homicides that you're going to be talking to him about and whether or not social media played a role in some of these. You're going to surprise yourself, and I think your listeners are going to be surprised to hear what he says.
Oh, no, that's a great point. I was out with my friend Dave Decatur, Sheriff Decatur, down in Stafford County, and this is exactly what he said. The law enforcement needs to start looking more seriously at social media because the criminals are figuring out ways to both communicate and basically plan their crimes on social media. So I think it's something law enforcement should be looking at.
All right. So what happens to these guys now? It's a pretty, I mean, it seems to be a pretty open and shut case, isn't it?
Well, you would think it's a pretty open and shut case. There's a lot of evidence, obviously. I think they're going to plea out. That's just my opinion with the amount of evidence that the police have. These are four major felonies. They can carry up to 30 years in prison. And again, I think it's important that we emphasize we're not talking juveniles, as one of the police officers said yesterday. These are just a bunch of dumb kids. No, no. We're talking adults. The oldest was 24 years old, one of the females was. So hopefully, they will be adjudicated to the point whereby, you know, they'll serve time and have the repercussions coming to them.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. Rod Wheeler, thank you so much.
Thanks, Rod,
for giving us your expertise. Greatly appreciate it in this very troubling story.
You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall, 5 to 9, Monday through Friday, only on 105.9 FM, WMAL. You're listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall.
You know, the Twitter machine is a fascinating place. There are all kinds of things that happen out on the Twitter machine that amuse and entertain and inform. But because of this, corporations have taken to Twitter to talk about their products from time to time. Such was the case with Wendy's. You know, Wendy's, they make hamburgers. And pretty good hamburgers, I would say. I love going to Wendy's now and then, eating one of them big old hamburgers, a double, you know, they're square. The patties are square.
Yeah.
I love that.
Well aware.
but anyway, they tweeted out on the 30th of December, just, you know, a little line to promote their product. Our beef is way too cool to ever be frozen. And that began an interaction that we found quite amusing between Wendy's and a person who identifies him or herself as Thuggy D. So here, for your entertainment value, our account of that conversation. I will portray the corporate voice of Wendy's.
Obviously.
And you, Vince, will portray the voice of Thuggy D.
As the guest, I get to be Thuggy D. This
All
makes
right.
sense.
So I'll start again. Our beef is way too cool to ever be frozen.
Your beef is frozen, and we all know it. Y'all know we laugh at your slogan, fresh, never frozen, right? Like, you're really a joke.
Sorry to hear you think that, but you're wrong. We've only ever used fresh beef since we were founded in 1969.
Oh, so you deliver it raw on a hot truck.
Where do you store cold things that aren't frozen?
Y'all should give up. McDonald's got you guys beat with that dope breakfast.
You don't have to bring them into this just because you forgot refrigerators existed for a second there.
And it's at that moment that Thuggy D deleted his Twitter account.
He was completely owned by
that's,
the people.
That's how you know you've obliterated someone, when they completely deactivate their Twitter account.
Apparently, the fans of Wendy, there are thousands and thousands of them, and apparently they all took to giving Thuggy D a hard time.
By the way, can more PR professionals please spend time just getting aggressive about their products instead of clinically using the most boring language ever to explain them?
And that's what I love about this, is that they didn't just let it sit. And that they engaged with the guy and then sort of shamed him about his claim.
They have a Donald Trump-level desire to rise to every challenge.
This is what Twitter has become right now. Twitter has become so incredible. There were some not long ago who said, Twitter, that's old hat. Nobody does Twitter anymore. I disagree. I think Twitter has become the most powerful social media platform out there, and Donald Trump proves it. Every time he tweets... As somebody said, as Sean Spicer said the other day, things actually happen. Yesterday, he tweets about this Office of Congressional Ethics, and all of a sudden, everybody on Capitol Hill gets in line and said, that looks dumb. We better stop that. Everybody got in line.
Right.
He does have an impact, and he has the ability to go directly to some 13 million people who follow him on Twitter.
And that didn't take a politically focused group, massaged process to figure out, what's our message going to be?
Yeah.
Trump said, you know what? I'm going to nip this thing in the butt. I'm going to use Twitter.
That's right. It's a pretty impressive thing. And congratulations to Wendy's for getting Thuggy D and putting him in line. Don't be messing with my big burgers.
I get myself a Frosty now.
I want one.
You've been listening to the best of Mornings on the Mall. Listen Monday through Friday, 5 to 9 a.m. to hear the show live.